This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million and tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Here comes that four-letter word again, jobs. Everybody's talking about today's unemployment report. How much does this one really matter? The candidates keep talking about the middle class. Who exactly do they mean? And Red Sox fans are talking about what a bummer this season's been. So dare I ask, why is Fenway still sold out? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Rizdahl, and this is the Marketplace podcast for Friday, September 7th. Thanks for being here. It's just a monthly jobs number. It'll be revised. But the August unemployment report out today was highly anticipated, especially by the presidential campaigns. So here goes. The unemployment rate fell to 8.1% from 8.3%, which sounds like good news, right? But the U.S. added just 96,000 jobs last month, not a whole lot. And the reason the unemployment rate dropped despite that is more and more Americans are giving up on the job market. From Washington, Marketplace's David Gura begins our coverage.
Kathy Holbrook works at a Nevada Job Connect Career Center in Reno. She says that on a typical day, 200 out-of-work Nevadans come to her office for help. And here's how they can go from optimistic to discouraged. At first, they say they'll take anything.
We have to kind of narrow it down. Anything isn't a job title.
Are there people who come to see you week after week after week looking for work?
Absolutely. We call them day campers.
Many day campers, as she calls them, try to find jobs for months.
We see a lot of people who have been looking for work for a very long period of time. And, you know, the longer they're unemployed, the harder it is for them to become reemployed.
And then Holbrook says someone she's seen week after week just won't come back. Heather Boucher doesn't blame them. She's an economist at the Center for American Progress.
Well, I don't know about you, but if I didn't have a job and I've been out there pounding the pavement for 6 months, 8 months, a year, maybe even 2 years, I think it would be enormously frustrating.
When you add up all the Americans who are no longer participating in the labor market and who are no longer looking for work, that's more than 2.5 million people. Many of them are not white, they tend to be older, and there are more men than women.
You know, the recession was incredibly hard on men in the first years of the recession, and men lost more jobs than women.
And they worked in sectors that were hard hit. Rick McGahey teaches public policy at the New School.
They tend to be concentrated somewhat in manufacturing. The manufacturing sector in the U.S., although it's coming back somewhat, is still a long way from fully providing the jobs that it did before we went into the recession.
And after Americans drop out of the labor market, McGahey says they try and scrape by as best they can. They might take Social Security early.
They need cash right away. If they've got retirement accounts, a lot of them don't. But if they do, they tend to cash those in.
And if they're younger, they might move back home to live with their parents. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Joining us now for the weekly wrap are Lee Gallagher of Fortune Magazine and John Carney at CNBC. Hi, guys.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi there.
Lee, let's start with you. You just heard that jobs counselor in Reno talk about the long-term unemployed. Lee, was there anything in today's report that would give those folks some kind of hope?
Well, it hasn't been the most disappointing report we've seen over the past 18 months. We can say that. It was disappointing. And this is after last month, which actually surprised on the other side. It was a lot better than people anticipated. So we're kind of, you know, bouncing along here around this kind of general state of, you know, the jobs market is not soaring back by any means, and it's not likely to anytime soon. So this is a persistent problem that we are going to have with us for a very long time, even though it feels like we've already had it with us for a very long time already. It's different from any other downturn we've seen in this regard.
Yeah. John, what stood out to you the most in this report, or what did you take from it?
It shows that the American economy has lost its ability to create a substantial amount of jobs on a sustained basis, and that's really troubling. Our economy is not built to withstand a very slow job creation. People have too much debts. We turn out too many people with too high college debts. These create fixed costs. We need jobs for people. If we're not creating them, the economy is in a lot of trouble.
Now, Lee, what do you think this means for President Obama? Do you think this report is going to sway a lot of undecided voters?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, this is one of the last major numbers to come out before the election, and the jobs number is more watched, especially by voters, than any other number. But the funny thing is, I think, you know, typically, historically, in elections, the economy, however the economy is kind of, you know, determines the election. But I think things have changed, and I think that there's a widespread understanding that the problems we're facing now are not due to policy. They're not due to any one, you know, they're bigger than any office, really. And you know, it's not like one person's going to win the election and fix everything. I think people understand that as well. So I don't think they're likely to change. Yeah. To move the needle.
John, do you agree?
I think that the Obama, the whole Democratic campaign yesterday did a great job of trying to make themselves sound as if they're the people who are going to create the jobs. We heard a lot of a lot of emphasis on the auto bailout, where it's not a very popular thing in America, but the Obama administration was hammering home the idea that they were able to preserve those jobs. So I think they're actually handling it quite well. And I'm surprised that Romney hasn't been able to get more traction when the economy is as bad as it is.
Yeah. Now, I know we ask this every time that jobless numbers come out, but now what about the Fed? Is the Fed going to do something in response, do you think? John?
Yeah, no, I think the Fed is definitely going to act. We don't know exactly what they're going to do, but they're almost certain to take some action at their next meeting. Whether that just means that they change the language they use to emphasize that they're going to stay more accommodative for an even longer period, or whether they actually go out and start buying various kinds of financial assets is not clear right now. But I'll guarantee right now that they will do something at their next meeting.
Yeah. Lee, do you agree?
I agree. I mean, the kind of drum roll is getting a little bit louder. We're kind of marching toward, or I guess slouching towards, doing something. You can kind of just tell something's going to happen. At this point, I think the bar is kind of high for not acting. And I think that the Fed at this point would need to be persuaded to hold fire. I think there's growing awareness that this economy is really struggling.
Right. I actually think the Fed was already persuaded it needed to act. And this latest jobs number was really the confirmation that they needed that the economy was as sluggish as they thought. If we got a great jobs number, that might have pushed off action for a while. Many people on the Fed want to take action. This number is the one that says, even though it's a backward-looking number, it tells them what had happened in the past, not what's happening in the future. But it tells them that the economic data we've been getting is confirmed. Jobs are not growing quickly enough for our economy.
Okay, we got to wrap it up there. John Carney at CNBC, Lee Gallagher at Fortune. Thanks a lot, guys, and have a good weekend.
Thanks so much.
You too.
Wall Street fairly unmoved by today's jobs report. Details when we do the numbers. Some of the unemployed and underemployed out there have been told they don't have the right skills for the jobs that do exist right now. policy folks like to call that the skills gap. Well, a Nevada pilot program, Right Skills Now, is trying to narrow that gap. It's the brainchild of the Manufacturing Institute. That's a group that works with about 11,000 American manufacturers. Youth Radio's Ross Andrews checked it out as part of our series Clocked In about the ways young people are finding work.
Meet the first woman to graduate from Nevada's Right Skills Now program.
Hi, I'm Katie Christian.
Christian is a 29-year-old mother of one. She's bubbly.
Absolutely.
And if you get her to laugh hard enough, she'll let out a snort or two. Before enrolling in the program, she had a bunch of different jobs.
I was a security guard at the Marine Corps base, and I also have been to culinary school. I love it, but it's a passion and a hobby, not a job for life.
A job for life is a lot to ask of any employment program, let alone one that only lasts 16 weeks. But Right Skills Now got Christian into the machine shop at GE's Bentley, Nevada facility. And she loves the work so much, she says she could do it for 40 years.
So now I have the spot drill coming in, getting ready to have the actual drill come in, and then the boring bar will come through.
The program that got Christian into this kind of work was piloted by a group called Dream It, Do It Nevada. Jonathan Begley is the executive director.
Our role in this whole thing is to take people from the unemployment lines and to connect them with employment quickly.
Dream It, Do It goes into community colleges with a different model. Classes are designed with an actual job in mind. Big employers like General Electric and small local companies are part of the mix. Students get a crash course in the basic skills, splitting time between the classroom and a paid internship on the factory floor.
Industry has really come up to the plate and said these are the types of workers that we need. There's an immediate demand among manufacturers for skilled CNC operators.
CNC stands for Computer Numerical Control. They're basically really expensive machines that are essential to factory work. And being able to run one makes a person pretty employable. Jim Fleming runs the GE plant where Katie Christian works. He's excited about a pipeline of CNC talent.
If you look around the tool room itself, you have about 20 pieces of equipment, most of them manual, run by 8 different guys who have been here for 35 to 40 years. One by one, these folks are going to be going away.
But at GE, they're not going away yet, which is one of the sticking points of Right Skills Now. It doesn't solve every company's immediate need. Fleming has been impressed with Christian's work, but he doesn't have a job for her, which is why she works as a temp. GE rules say Christian has a year to get hired before she'll be forced to leave. If that happens, she says she'll take her CNC skills and borrow a line from Ginger Rogers. She'll pick herself up.
Brush yourself up and start all over again.
Don't lose your confidence if you slip. Be grateful for a pleasant trip and pick yourself up. Dust
brush yourself off, start all over again. Bump, bump. I'm Ross Andrews for Marketplace.
Ross's story was produced for our series Clocked In by Youth Radio and its New Options Desk. They're reporting on how young adults can find work. Okay, enough about jobs for now. Let's take a break and go to the ballpark. Fenway Park in particular. As baseball fans know, the Boston Red Sox have had a disaster of a season. After trading some of their star players last month, they've lost 8 of their last 9 games. And frankly, most Boston fans have kind of given up. But somehow Fenway Park still sells out. Tonight is on track to be the 783rd sellout in a row, a record not just in baseball, but in all major league sports. Which raises the question, what's a sellout streak worth anyway? Kurt Nickisch reports from WBUR in Boston.
Boston opened the season with the third highest payroll in baseball, $173 million. But now the Red Sox are barely out of last place in their division.
It's gotten so bad so quickly in so many ways.
Sox fan Jeff Werner says the only bright spot is that after 7 years on the waiting list, he's finally been offered a ticket package. It's diehard fans like him that keep the home sellout record going. Andrew Zimbalist, a sports economist at Smith College, says that's worth something.
The sellout streak creates a sensation, an image of this is a hot ticket, this is a place you want to be. Aren't you a lucky person to have one of the scarce tickets to a Red Sox game?
That increased demand helps keep sales strong. When the Cleveland Indians sellout streak ended at 455 games, attendance crashed. But the enduring Red Sox sellouts have come under fire. There were rows of open seats at the last home game. Sam Kennedy is a team executive.
We understand that the literal sense of the word, people may assume there's not one ticket to be had, but that's not the case.
The Red Sox call it a sellout, even if somebody bought a ticket but doesn't show up, and the team counts tickets it donates to charity, even if they go unused. Many fans say the streak seems dubious, and Andrew Zimbalist, the sports economist, wonders if it has outlived its value.
I imagine that the ownership of the Red Sox would not be at all disappointed if they were able to announce that the sellout streak had ended.
After all, he says, the Red Sox have one of the smallest ballparks in Major League Baseball. All they have to do is sign some exciting new players in the offseason, and it shouldn't be that hard to fill the stands again. In Boston, I'm Kurt Nickisch for Marketplace.
Coming up, the Democratic and Republican conventions are over, but this refrain won't go away.
Middle-class families.
The middle class of America.
The middle class.
The middle class.
Defining the middle class, it's complicated, but first, let's do the numbers. A muted day to end a booming week on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average ticked up 14 points, or 0.1%, to close at 13,306. The NASDAQ was basically flat and finished at 3,136. The S&P 500 gained 5 points, 0.4%, to close at 1,437. For the week, the Dow rose 1.6%, the NASDAQ surged 2.3%, and the S&P 500 tacked on 2.2%. Financial shares extended their gains for a second day. Bank of America led the pack again, climbing 5.3%. Morgan Stanley was a close second, depositing 5.1%. European markets ended the week on the upswing. London's FTSE rose 0.3%. France's CAC 40 added 0.25%, and the German DAX gained 0.2%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.66%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve is scheduled to release its report on consumer credit for July. A sign that summer is winding down, Congress returns from break. And on September 10th, 1993, the television series The X-Files debuted. The truth is still out there. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Rizdahl. So, the euro today hit a two-month high against the dollar. And as we mentioned, European stock markets kept rallying. Investors there are still basking in yesterday's news of a plan to sort out the eurozone debt crisis. But ironically, the plan has raised fresh doubts about Greece. And companies here and in Europe are hedging their bets, preparing for Greece to leave the eurozone, even though it might not happen. We begin in London with Marketplace's Stephen Beard.
Greece has tried the patience of its eurozone partners. It's regularly failed to deliver all the agreed budget cuts and economic reforms. But Greece had one powerful factor on its side. Its partners were terrified that a Greek exit, commonly called Grexit, would unravel the euro. That fear may now recede because yesterday's plan effectively put a firewall around other vulnerable eurozone countries like Spain and Italy. Jan Randolph of IHS Global Insight says letting Greece go is not so risky now.
Greece has a lot less leverage because the firewalls are up now. The contagion impacts far less.
And that seems likely to accelerate a trend that's gathered speed this year. Foreign companies have been winding down their business with Greece for obvious reasons. Corporate lawyer Chris Robinson asks who wants to be trading with the Greeks just as they might have to quit the eurozone and adopt a new currency.
the new drachma would be worth a great deal less than the existing euro. And anybody who had sold goods to Greece on credit, who was then paid in the new drachma, would be very seriously disadvantaged.
Several big British corporations have admitted they're taking no chances. Vodafone, the cell phone giant, and Glaxo, the pharmaceutical firm, both sweep money out of Greece and back into the UK every evening. Bank analyst Ralph Silver says the big British banks have also been bracing for Grexit.
I think the large banks are pretty well there. I'd say if it was out of 100% preparedness, they'd be about 75 to 80% prepared.
Greek assets have been sold and credit lines terminated, and the banks may be anticipating Grexit in another way. No one will confirm this, but there have been persistent reports that the trading floors of London will be ready at the flick of a switch to deal in the new Greek currency. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
And I'm Heidi Moore in New York. J.P. Morgan says that big U.S. companies are far more worried than European ones about whether the euro will survive. So the bank put together a kind of what to expect when you're expecting a financial disaster.
We published a book, you know, it's a small booklet. It actually details 50 points that every corporation should be considering in terms of being ready for the introduction of a new currency.
John Gibbons is in charge of J.P. Morgan's treasury services in Europe, the Middle East, and Africa. He's also been helping those big companies create new bank accounts to hold a currency that doesn't even exist yet.
The clients established these, what we would call a phantom currency, on their systems and then on our systems, and then are ready to operate in a new currency overnight.
Creating a plan to handle a new currency isn't easy. For one thing, where would you start?
There's definitely been times when the market's been worried about Spain, worried about Italy, worried about Portugal, Ireland, Greece.
That's why Wynne Rumpleton, a vice president of sovereign risk at State Street Bank, compares her company's plan to military strategy.
We have sort of a war room that we would create. People understand that they'd have to be at their stations.
Adam Schneider at Deloitte Consulting says the plans he's seen from U.S. companies are enormous.
It's probably best to think of them as loose leaf books on the order of hundreds of pages.
U.S. companies have started acting on them already. Many have renegotiated their contracts to switch out of euros and into dollars and British pounds. And the chemicals giant FMC is asking its Greek clients to pay in advance.
That was Heidi Moore in New York, and before that, Stephen Beard in London on plans on both sides of the pond for a possible Grexit. Well, the political conventions are all over, and in case you didn't hear this phrase enough...
Middle-class families.
The middle class of America.
The middle class.
The middle class.
Chrissy Clark from our Wealth and Poverty Desk has been listening closely to both candidates and just who they're appealing to. Hi, Chrissy.
Hi, Sarah.
So, Chrissy, just who is this middle class that both the Democrats and the Republicans have been appealing to?
Well, I've been asking around, and the answer I got from one guy was pretty illustrative.
Don't go asking questions like that. You're going to ruin everything.
That was economist Doug Holtz-Eakin. He was one of the senior advisors for the last Republican presidential nominee, John McCain. Of course, Holtz-Eakin was being a little tongue-in-cheek, but it gets to the slippery Rorschach-testness of the phrase middle class on either side of the aisle, especially during a presidential campaign. Because don't forget, almost half of Americans describe themselves as middle class, even though that covers a huge spectrum of incomes.
Right. But how do economists actually define middle class?
Well, not rich and not poor. One of the simplest definitions I've seen is all adults with annual household incomes between about $40,000 and $120,000.
So after listening to both the Democratic convention, the Republican convention, what do we know now about how Romney defines middle class and how Obama defines middle class?
Of course, that's hard to say definitively, but just for kicks, I did a word count of how many times each man used the phrase. Obama used it 5. Romney used it twice, but then Romney used entrepreneur once and Obama never used that one. So maybe that says something about the kind of middle class person Romney is focused on. As for specific phrases, I was struck in Romney's speech when he said,
"Unlike President Obama, I will not raise taxes on the middle class of America."
Now, maybe Romney's talking about the penalties that uninsured people would have to pay under Obama's health care plan. Or maybe he's talking about Obama's proposal to increase taxes on households making over $250,000, in which case that also says something about who Romney includes in the middle class.
And so, Chrissy, what about Obama's speech then?
Well, one of the middle class moments in his speech was when he said,
I refuse to ask middle class families to give up their deductions for owning a home or raising their kids just to pay for another millionaire's tax cut.
So Obama's drawing a much brighter line between the middle class and the rich. He also made a lot of references to education and college as a gateway to opportunity. Of course, if you talk to economists, most jobs in the next several decades won't be owning small businesses or being educated white-collar professionals. Most of the jobs will be in the service sector, janitors, home healthcare workers, restaurant servers. So the real trick is to turn those jobs that the bulk of Americans will have into middle-class jobs.
Right. Chrissy Clark from our Wealth and Poverty Desk. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And finally, it's been a heavy week of news, so here's a look at what didn't quite make the headlines. Here are Brendan Francis Noonan and Rico Galliano, along with some of the Marketplace staff.
Mary Du, who directed today's show, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Yeah, so this story's actually been out for a little while, but I'm still incredibly interested in it. So there's this Swedish guy, he's an entrepreneur, and he started a social media website for the 1%. It's called Best of All Worlds.
It's for the wealthy?
He pegs it as, it's for the wealthy and for people with sophisticated taste. So I'm assuming that means there's not going to be any posts about, you know, what we had for breakfast and that kind of thing.
It'll all be like, just earned $1 million off of interest sitting in my bed.
Like it.
It sounds kind of boring.
Well, I think the people updating their pages, it's not going to be these rich people. It's probably going to be their butlers, and they know where all the bodies are buried. So I think it's going to be pretty juicy.
Mark Garrison, New York reporter, what's your story?
A Bob Dylan bond.
What is a Bob Dylan bond?
So Goldman Sachs is getting ready to roll out a bond that's based on the royalties of musicians, including Bob Dylan. But it's nice to just call it the Bob Dylan bond. And it was originally going to be rated BBB-. It got delayed, but now they're reforming it. It's going to have two tranches. They're putting that together.
You know what? I have no idea what you're saying, which is probably why it's called the Bob Dylan bond.
John Huss, editor, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
A guy named Ron Akana retired from United Airlines this week. He was the longest-running flight attendant in the history of aviation.
Really? How many years?
63 years. He actually has a Guinness Book of World Records award for it now, and he flew to Hawaii on his last mission and flew back to retire in Colorado.
And with some luck, his bags will show up in a few days.
Rico and Brendan host a radio show called The Dinner Party. There's a link to their podcast on our website, marketplace.org. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow ticked up 14 points, or 0.1%, to close at 13,306. The NASDAQ was basically flat and finished at 3,136. And the S&P 500 gained 5 points, 0.4%, to close at 1437. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitara Nieves. The executive producer is Deborah Clark. J.J. Yor is the vice president and general manager. Coming up this weekend on Marketplace Money... Ever get so furious at your coworkers you just want to break down and cry? Some experts say go for it.
41% of women reported that they had cried during the last year in the workplace, and 9% of men. And crying made no difference whatsoever in terms of a person's success.
I'm Sarah Gardner. Have a great weekend. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.